You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Wow. How are you feeling, mate?
I'm a lot more relaxed now.
Are you, though?
Yeah.
Like, we are week two
of
2021. How are you coping? Like, do you have a to-do list for the kids to keep them occupied?
Like, we've been smashing them through.
Like what? Give us...
Zoo,
hang
beach.
On a second, hang on a second. So, for all our listeners out there,
yeah,
those parents that are... that are just climbing the walls. They've been climbing the walls for all of 2020.
Mm.
Give us some suggestions of what you could do with the kids.
Just get out of the house. I reckon that's number one.
Yeah.
Park.
Get everyone out of the house, or you just lock yourself in the house and lock the kids out.
Exactly. Anything to get them outdoors. Because, you know, kids, especially of a certain age, will gravitate towards their computers or TVs or something like that, even on a beautiful day. And if you move them out of the house, go down to a playground, park with a dog, or take the bikes out, head to the beach, go, you know, if it's a rainy day, take them to 10-pin bowling, those sorts of things.
How's your 10-pin bowling form, by the way?
Awful. And it never was good.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me. Mm. What else is on your list?
Well,
is it because you don't like the shoes?
No, the shoes are okay. It's just the coordination of it. I think my thumb gets stuck in the hole.
Okay.
I was pretty good at bumper bowling.
Yeah.
Where you can't miss.
What else is on the list? Help those parents that are going, what do I do with these kids?
Well, yeah, I'm not sure that I'm the oracle of truth when it comes to parenting skills and
you
activities.
You are today. Yeah, you are today.
Maybe
I've got one.
Yeah, what?
So, you know how kids, they're... There was actually a study done out of the States, I don't know, let's say 2020, and they asked all of these kids between the ages of 8 and 12, what do you want to be when you grow up? And traditionally, you go back 20, 30 years, people would have said plumber, electrician, own my own IT professional services business, banker, whatever they said. Well, this study came back and said, I want to be a YouTuber.
Oh.
So I actually, Miller went to Code Camp last year.
Yeah.
This year, they've got 3 days where you can go off and learn how to create your own YouTube channel and YouTube show. So I was thinking, kids love tech.
Yeah.
Why don't you say to them, all right, you're on your tech. Let's put some creativity behind this. Create a TV show. I want you to storyboard it. So write down what it's called. There's got to be hours, if not days, in that. And when they're, you know, when you need them to do something, get them to go and create a new episode. What do you think about that?
That's a great idea.
Right.
What's Miller's TV show going to be called?
I think it's called Realm.
Realm?
Realm.
Or Realm?
No, Realm.
What does Realm mean?
It's just Miller backwards. That's what he said to me the other day. I'm going to call it Realm. I said, well, what about, where'd that come? Just back the front.
Yeah, the old Da Vinci. Nice.
The thing for me about I just loved January school holidays.
As a kid?
As a kid, absolutely loved it. You know, out on the dragster, cruising up and down the streets with my friends and, you know, backyard cricket.
Yeah.
The community was just there and out and about. What did you love about school holidays?
Well, school holidays for me was going home again because I boarded my schooling. And
were your parents happy about that? You're coming back to the into the fold? Or?
Well, Mum is a passionate listener to this podcast.
she is.
I'm sure she loved us coming home.
Yeah.
But it was tons and tons of backyard cricket with my brother and interspersed with icy poles in between the sweaty sessions of backyard cricket, which were very, they were taken very seriously.
Yeah.
We were fully padded up in the backyard and,
cricket ball or tennis?
Yeah, cricket, yeah.
Actual cricket ball.
Actual
not
cricket
a tennis ball.
No, it took a lot of skill to not. We never broke a window.
Never broke a window.
Never broke a window.
Oh, well, I was saying to Miller the other day, because he broke something. Can't remember what it was. Anyway, I said to him, mate, don't worry about it. Like when I was a kid, I reckon I broke 15 windows. Not in one summer, but over the duration.
No, we had to learn to be very controlled.
Yeah. That's probably why you're a good cricketer and I'm not. Anyway, just spending time in the community and it was such a cracking time. Hey, here's a seamless segue into our next guest. Our next guest, Rob Spurr, created some amazing communities.
Yeah, and it's the type of community that you just expect always existed. It was always there.
Yeah.
And when you hear this story about how Rob saw an overseas AFL league, sport that he grew up loving, played at a really good level, when you hear that story of how it was created, and there is a big difference between being a custodian of a club, so taking it over, like I do at the local football club, you just carry on and take the torch and carry it forwards for another few years. Being a founder of a club in a foreign country to a foreign code of where it's just not played, it's quite an incredible journey, and it is doing to a T.
Sure is. And there's also an amazing tip throughout the course of the episode on how to draw a crowd.
Yes, this story
by
is amazing.
Swinging a fish around your head.
Here's Rob Spurr. Blake, do you like stories of people doing?
I love stories of people doing, Nick.
Well, if you out there like stories of people doing and you want us to make more stories of people doing, then like this podcast, subscribe, and tell your mates, because the more people we have listening, the more episodes we can make, and that's better for everyone out there who's doing or wants to do.
And as Arnold would say,
do it.
I thought he said I'll be back.
G'day, Rob. Welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
Going very well. Thanks for having me on.
No pleasure. Nick, how are you? How good? We're back in the studio.
Yeah.
It is just about December, just about summer. Sun is beaming in. How good is it?
It's great. This is the first in-studio interview we've had since March.
Is that right?
Now nearly December. Good to have you on.
Thank you very much. Yeah, it's good to be here and just spent the weekend driving the kids around, kids sport and all that again, and it was good for a couple of weeks. Now I'm starting to complain again.
Yeah, but, it's back, isn't it?
Yeah.
A mate of mine's got a name for that. He calls himself the Doober, the Daddy Uber.
Not bad.
Yeah, quite liked it. Hey, Rob, tell the Doolanders, what do you do?
It's an interesting time to ask me that because I'm on a career break at the moment, a planned career break. So the idea was to take a bit of time after my last role and work out what's next. And then, of course, COVID came along, which wasn't in the plan. I had a plan of travelling, golf, playing guitar and all that good stuff and supporting my wife as she was lifting her career up. And then COVID came along, so homeschooling was put into the equation. Quick, damn smart.
How was your homeschooling ability?
I wasn't that good at it, it turns out. But,
is that feedback from the kids? Or?
Yeah. I was every time I tried to interfere, I was sort of shown the door. But no, they did pretty well, I think.
Nice. Self-starters. You've raised some self-starters, have you?
I wouldn't say that, yeah. It was a mixed bag. I think like all families, we just found a way and got through.
Got it done. Mm. Hey, congratulations. Although you are on a sabbatical and a career break, you have a new appointment. Tell us a little bit about that.
New appointment? Oh, yeah, a couple of weeks ago I was appointed to the AFL's Asia Advisory Board, which is a little board obviously put together to support the growth of footy up in Asia. So I've got a two-year gig to support the AFL and their ambitions up in Asia, and the guys that are doing fantastic volunteer work up there.
Yeah, congratulations. One of the reasons that we wanted to have you on was not about your homeschool teaching ability, but the work that you've done abroad when bringing communities together around sport. You've had an amazing career in the finance sector and in the renewables sector, and we also wanted to touch on that. So before we do that, though, what we like to do is we like to, you know, go back to the beginning and where it all started. So when you think about when the opening ball was bounced for Rob Spur, where was that? Where'd that all happen?
In the exotic eastern suburbs of Melbourne. I grew up in Doncaster. I will say a little pocket of Doncaster. It was a little sort of a German enclave. I went to a little school called Waldo Primary School, and up the road was Reichsicks Reserve. You might know where the athletics track is, and Schramm's Cottage and a Lutheran church. So, and all these little orchards around. So it's, it was quite an interesting little place to grow up.
And as you grew up through, you know, your early years, was football and sport a part of what you did?
It was pretty much, footy and cricket was pretty much all we did, out on the street and down at the local Doncaster Heights Footy Club down at Reichsicks Reserve there, and played cricket down there as well. So half my life was spent on that park down there.
Yeah. Brothers, sisters?
I do. I've got two older sisters and a younger brother. We also had a beautiful foster sister who lived with us was part of our family for 40 years. She passed away about 8 years ago now, but she came to live with us when she was a 14-year-old. Yeah.
And that's a pretty amazing story. You were sharing that with me the other day. Tell us a little bit about how that came to pass.
Yeah, well, Sue was a, I guess, came from an underprivileged family. She was living with her auntie in the back of a milk bar in North Blackburn in Kerrymuir there, and which was quite close to my grandmother's house and was a shop that our family used to visit quite a lot. So we got to know Sue because she was working in the shop. She developed lymphoma, a form of cancer, when she was quite young. I think she was 14 and went to hospital. Mum went in to visit her in hospital one day, and she looked up and said, "Mrs. Spur, when I get out of hospital, can I come and live with you?" And Mum said, okay. So overnight, you know, there was bedrooms being shifted, and we got a new sister who we had for the next 40 years.
Just like that.
Just like that. I'm pretty sure there was no paperwork involved or anything. We just we just got this delightful sister.
Mm. And as a part of the family, how did you adjust? Or it just happened?
Well, I think I was probably only five at the time, so I don't remember anything else. I had three sisters instead of two. Yeah. But she was a she was a great part of our family, and her family now are part of our family too. Yeah.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. So your mum and dad obviously were, you know, very giving people, and were there to help her out.
Yeah, it was a great thing to do looking back. But we've only kind of reflected on that recently. It was because that's kind of all we've known. We didn't really reflect on what a great thing it was to do till later in life. Yeah.
Yeah. So you're also, go back to, I'll touch on footy in a minute, but you also played a bit of music. You like to pick up the brass, is that right?
Yeah, from when I was a teenager, I learnt brass at high school, and I had a family of brass players, lots of uncles, cousins. We all played brass instruments, so I played in a couple of bands, brass bands, and also a fantastic little brass quintet that used to do gigs around Melbourne as well.
So tell us a little bit about that brass quintet. Were you busking one day? And tell us a little bit about how you earned some coin through that experience.
Yeah, we did do a lot of busking. I think I was at high school or uni at the time, so it was a bit easier to do. We'd go into Bourke Street Mall and get our place. There was some pretty hot competition at the time. You had these, you know, the swinging sidewalks that were always on Hey Hey It's Saturday.
Oh, yeah.
Doug Anthony Allstars up the other end, so it was a tough gig in there, trying to get some gold coins out of people. But there was one particular day we were outside Myers. We had the main doors of Myers covered at Christmas, And we had a good little crowd going. And lo and behold, a guy came back from the market. He was drunk as a skunk and he'd been buying fish of all things. And he had it in some newspaper. Came past, we were playing a bit of music. He started dancing, pulled the fish out of the wrapper, held it by the tail, started swinging it around. All hell broke loose. People started coming from everywhere to watch. It was the biggest crowd we'd ever had. We blocked off the Maya doors. Then we blocked off the trams. We had so many people. The city kind of came to a standstill for a couple of minutes. And just by pure luck, the marketing manager of Maya came out to see what all the kerfuffle was about.
Yeah.
And said, you know, oh, you guys are great. And have you got a business card? And next thing we know, we're Maya's kind of house band. Anytime they had a function on or a sale, we were dragged in probably five or six times a year to do, you know, Cup Week or Valentine's Day or Christmas. And then all the other stores got onto us, so we do, you know, a city store in the morning and Doncaster in the afternoon, all because of this dude who
the man with swung the fish.
Yeah, we owe him a lot.
You do owe him a lot.
Did he come on as the conductor?
he just got right into it, and I can still remember the scene quite vividly. It was just quite bizarre, but people just loved it. They came from everywhere.
Did he form part of your act in the future, or you dropped him?
He was dropped quite quickly, but, we do owe him a lot.
You do? Do you remember the song you were playing as he was really getting into it?
I don't remember the song, but it would have been, you know, an upbeat march, like the Radetzky March or something like that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Right. Okay. I can see it now. I love that. And the marketing managers peered out the window and, I better go down and have a look what's going on there.
Yeah, why are the trams dinging and they're all banked up?
That is fantastic. Mm. Hey, as you were growing up as a teenager and you think about through your school years, was it clear to you what you wanted to do with your life from a vocation perspective?
No, not really. And I don't think looking back we had all the guidance through our schools back then. We sort of drifted through. I did math science at school because my sisters did and that was a thing to do.
Yeah.
Didn't really love it that much, and basically just made a split second decision to flip across to commerce and finance when I went to uni. There was no great thought put into it at the time that I remember.
Yeah,
I think my friend was going to the same uni, so I decided I'd go with him.
It's always a good reason, isn't it?
Well, I think it's quite amazing how many, you know, people that we talk to at that point in their life where you're choosing subjects and choosing what you're going to do next, got no idea. Just go and do something.
Yeah.
So you headed off to Deakin, you did economics, and you had a chance to travel overseas with the brass band, is that right? Headed off to Edinburgh and some pretty exciting things happened over there, is that right?
Yeah, it was 1988 and I took a year off university and travelled with the band. It was the Preston Brass Band at the time. And we went up and played in the Edinburgh Festival Contest and we had a Scottish conductor who wanted to take his group home and did a three-week concert tour through Britain afterwards and played in some great places all around the UK and London and then travelled with a couple of guys from the band for 5 months afterwards doing the whole Australian thing of scrapping a few coins together to get by and work through the youth hostels. Yeah, terrific.
Found yourself on the front page of a newspaper, is that right? Or was that a little later?
Mm. No, that was on the same tour, yeah. We were going through Turkey and we had a... that's right. We found ourselves in a... I won't say a fracas, but some guys that were staying in the youth hostel and we were in the bar in the youth hostel and they'd had a disagreement with the guy who ran the hostel. It was a YHA hostel as well. And unbeknown to them, the guy had some pretty... good mates in the military who showed up in two buses with guns and marched a lot of us out at gunpoint up to our bunks and set us off to, we had to walk down the street with our backpacks, find another hostel and again, unbeknown to us, the people from the second hostel knew a journalist. The journalist came down, got the whole story, took some photos and we had a big night that night, got up in the morning, walked down the main street and there's our faces on the front page of the national Turkish newspaper. We're like the number one news story for the day.
Have you still got that
clipping.
I've got it.
Okay, straight to the website.
Yeah, that's going on the show notes.
No doubt, no doubt. So you did the Aussie thing, you travelled around, and although you weren't exactly sure of what you wanted to do and you did economics at Deakin, you must have been pretty good at it because ICI picked you up as the very first finance graduate. Is that right?
Yeah, I got a bit lucky. They took two of us in, but they put together a graduate program and took two of us into the first one, which was good. Meant having to do the hard yards out in the western suburbs and some pretty grubby factories and stuff to get going. They made you earn your stripes before you went into head office, but they had a really good finance function and looked after us really well.
So what does ICI do, for those who don't know?
Well, they were sort of a top 10 British company at the time. That were into all sorts of chemicals, I guess. And I think at the time they owned Dulux and Sally's here in Australia. Chemicals, plastics, blasting stuff, explosives, those type of things. Heavy industry.
Yeah. Mm. I think I just heard your jaw click. How did that happen?
Yes, you might have. I do have a wonky jaw, courtesy of a bit of a hit I got playing footy. We had a really fantastic footy side at my high school down at Doncaster High, and we were the first high school to make the final of the Herald Cup. So we played four games out at Waverley, and a couple of them were televised on Channel 7 the Sunday mornings with commentary. So that was really exciting for teenage kids, but. Yeah, and the first one of those, I got my jaw whacked pretty hard in a game, and it's been unfixable ever since.
So, should we have a demonstration of this? But I guess there's a bit of listener discretion advised.
Tune out. Yeah.
No, my wife actually hates it. So
does she?
She just drives her nuts. But
yeah. So do you finish an argument with that?
It's like it clicks when I eat, and she says. Can you just stop that and go, I'm eating. Like, what do you want me to do? Yeah. Use a straw.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So she's clearly pureeing your food from here on in. So you said you had to go out west and do all of the hard yards, as you generally do when you join a business at that level, I guess. But ICI took you around the globe. It took you from Kalgoorlie to Vietnam and Singapore. So tell us a bit about that journey, and was that purposeful? Did you want to go and work abroad throughout your career?
Yeah, I think broadly it was part of the plan. So I did a few years with them in Melbourne and then moved up to their mining division up in Sydney. I had 2 years there and in a marketing team, which was a great role, as you say, moving all around from Kalgoorlie to Townsville, Northern Territory, lots of travel, and then joined their international division after 2 years and was sent up to Vietnam to do a project for 6 months, my first expat posting, down to Singapore to work on to do a restructure, which was a bit nasty for first time I've had to do something like that. And then the Asian financial crisis hit, and I was sent down to Indonesia for 6 months to sort out a bunch of issues to do with some failed banks down there, and ended up staying for 6 years.
And you were posted in Jakarta, is that right?
Mm.
So talk to us about Jakarta in 1998 and the 6 years that you stayed there and what ensured from a cultural perspective.
Well, it was an interesting time to go. 1998, my first month, was pretty much the time that Jakarta blew up on May the 14th. So I'd been there only for 3 weeks, and I remember going to work one day, driving past the National Stadium to get to work where my office was, and inside the National Stadium there was a whole bunch of army tanks lined up, ready to go. And I thought, geez, this is going to be an interesting day. And got into work and people were gathered around radios. It was just like the movie Year of Living Dangerously almost. There was people gathered around listening to what was going on as these protests were kicking off against the Suharto government after all the economic crises has hit. People's lives had been quite hard at the time. The currency had crashed from think it was 1,500 to the US dollar to 12,000. So the equivalent of the Aussie dollar going to, say, 15 cents overnight. Oh, wow. So there was a lot of tension and a lot of turmoil. And, yeah, and then it all sort of came to a head one day on May the 14th and blew up. We were sent home from the office, went up to my apartment. I thought, wasn't sure how long this was going to go for. And so went down to the local kiosk to probably buy some food. It was all wiped out already. There was no food. So, all went from there.
So I think the 6 years that you were there, there were four presidents, bombings. Just what was it like being a guy that grew up in the leafy southeastern suburbs of Melbourne in Doncaster, going to a place where it was bedlam? What did you do to remain sane?
Some would say I didn't, but I guess the just carrying on. I guess that you're right. There were four presidents. They went from when I was there, they transitioned from the military government from Suharto into. He transferred power in November to BJ Abebe, and then across to Abdul Rahman Wahid, and then to Megawati. An amazing transition of power from a military government. Like, they did such an amazing job. You could almost set your clock that every 6 months something would happen. There'd be some sort of an uprising, a change of power. There was a couple of rounds of bombings, the Bali bombing in 2002, the Marriott bombing in Jakarta in 2003. There was just always something going on. So, I guess the way to answer your question we kept saying was through sport. My wife Tara set up a netball club, which became really, really successful over there, and I joined a fledgling footy club, the Jakarta Footy Club, which was just a terrific sporting organisation, probably the best I've ever been part of. A fantastic bunch of guys doing really good stuff.
Before we delve into that, because you played a really significant role in the 6 years building out that club and that community, you mentioned your wife, Tara.
Mm.
You met your wife, Tara, in Jakarta, is that right?
I did. She came up in about 2001, I think, 2001. Tara speaks fluent Bahasa Indonesia. She's from Adelaide and a lawyer, so she was moved up there, part of a law firm after the financial crisis to sort out a lot of the debt restructuring and things like that for the Indonesian government. We had a bit of an unconventional start to our relationship. The way we met was basically I was heading back to a cousin's wedding in Adelaide for a weekend, and I got a call from a friend of mine who was also Tara's boss saying that Tara had been in a rather serious accident, and by accident I mean she was subject of her and her flatmate that we were jogging, and they were subject to a random attack with a guy carrying a machete, some crazy dude with a machete. She was seriously injured, her arm was seriously injured, and needed microsurgery, and her flatmate, Dave, he did a microsurgery on his face, which had been cut quite badly down the middle. So Dave was sent to Darwin, and then, I had this call to ask me if I could chaperone Tara back to Adelaide. So it was quite serendipitous. We were going back to Adelaide for different reasons. So I'd met her only once before at a dinner party, and we hadn't really spoken. So this was the first time we'd met. And I took her back to Adelaide through Sydney, and she was in quite a bad way, and delivered her to her obviously delirious parents. And we said goodbye, and I thought, well, I'll probably never see her again. She'll never come back.
yeah.
And bloody hell, she came back 2 months later.
She came back.
So anyone who knows Tara would...
Why though? Why? Like after that experience, you're going to go, no way.
Yeah, well, I think she had all the microsurgery done, got her arm fixed up, had all of her rehab, and she was having a great time up there. And, anyone who knows her would know that she's quite determined and quite, quite balanced, and she wasn't going to let her... a crazy what-off incident get in the way of her international dream, I guess. So yeah, she came back.
So what is it about living and working in Indonesia? I mean, you're living through turmoil. Yet with the thoughts, I should come home. It's too dangerous.
We got to that point in 2004. There was sort of too much going on. We got to the point where we were going to get a coffee in Starbucks and somebody would put something in the bin and you'd look to see what was being put in the bin, you know. Because everywhere you went, if you pulled up at your office, they'd check under your car for bombs. You go to a restaurant, they'd check under your car for bombs. When the Marriott bombing happened in 2003, they found the safe house, which was at a little town about 2 hours out of Jakarta, and they found the safe house and they had a list of all the potential targets and, you know, our complex was one of them. So there was a few things ticking off. You know, the Bali bombs had happened 2002, the year before, and we'd lost friends in that. So kind of we thought it was time to go in 2004.
So going to wind back to sport. So Jakarta, 6 years. Tell us about, Tara played netball, you played footy. Tell us about that experience, how it started for you, and I guess what you were part of and what you created over that six-year journey.
So I guess what happened playing footy in Jakarta was three things. The first one was to be part of a really professional footy club that's developed. And a couple of things came out of that time. The first thing was the development of what was called the Asian Championships. So we really created a league and for clubs all around Asia to meet once a year. And
how many clubs were in that league?
The first one was, I think the first comp we had in Jakarta in 2000, there was eight teams come.
Okay.
Now, last year, 2019, 20 countries, four divisions, women's footy, 600 players attended. It's a really, it's really amazing. Big event that moves around Asia.
Yeah,
it's an event in itself. So that started there. I guess the other thing was really setting up an Indonesian development program. When we were there, we were at the very start of that when I was there. We managed to get some money out of AusAid in my last year there to put in a full-time coach and really get the game going. And 10 years later, 2014... we managed to get our team down to the International Cup here in Melbourne. The guys up in Indonesia did a fantastic job fundraising and training those kids over 10 years. They were out of schools and orphanages, these kids, and suddenly they're playing footy in Melbourne. And I managed to get down to the community round in 2014. They played a game down in Diggers Rest, of all places, and Indonesia played France. And never been a bigger day down in Diggers Rest. It was just amazing watching this international footy. It was a really, really proud day to see it.
Yeah, great work. So, like, you were saying earlier that you think about everything that was going on in Jakarta, and you know, it really helped you and Tara and others from a mental health perspective and from a fitness perspective. Like, I'd imagine it was a great escape, and there was a bunch of like-minded people within that community.
Yeah, exactly. And training once a week on a Sunday morning was the thing you could kind of set your clock by. I probably didn't realise it at the time, how needed it was to go out and get to really peak fitness. To play footy in Asia, you need to be super fit.
How hot is it?
It's got a low to mid-30s, but it's the humidity that kills you, and you're sort of, within the first 10 minutes of a game, you're actually breathing fire, and it's really hard work.
And
it's a tough gig. They also play a lot of games in a tournament format, so you've got to take big squads to be able to get through a full day of a tournament. You might play three games and make a final. So you need to. When we won the Asian Champs in 2002, I think we took, 35 guys up to play. We need to be able to rotate to win that.
Yeah. And the work and effort that you put in to, I guess, increase the size of that league or team or organisation, what was the rationale behind why you wanted to do just that?
Well, I think there's a personal element. Yeah, one was just it's bloody good fun.
Playing
footy around Asia, you have so much fun. I counted back after I left, I'd been on sort of 19 trips playing footy for a park footballer in Melbourne. That was good fun. Sense of community, there was a whole community set up around it, not only the footy club but the netball club and the cricket club were all associated, and meet lots of people, and it was, you know, your whole sort of social life was based around the footy club.
Yeah.
And I think also bringing together the expats and also the people of the host nation at that time, Indonesia, just being able to play footy with Indonesians and mix, it was kind of like this sport became this part of this sort of diplomatic thing, sports diplomacy.
Yeah.
It was great bringing communities together, I guess, yeah.
Created your own culture, I guess, a hybrid of...
sort of micro-communities, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, amazing. Were you any good as a footy player?
I was okay. I was good in Asia, probably not good domestically.
So that's the real reason why you're over there.
Yeah, could get a kick up there.
Yeah.
I was okay. I managed to...
You were the captain, weren't you?
I captained Indonesia to the 2002 Asian Champs, so that was good.
So you went all right. Yeah.
National captain, take that.
National captain of another country.
No, it doesn't matter. It all counts.
Yeah. No, it was good. We had a great group that year that we won, and a fantastic coach brought in called Neil Thompson, who was our military attaché for Indonesia at the time, and a guy who'd done so much to stabilise East Timor and then went into Iraq at the time to head up the UN, and he was the guy who did the Bali bombings rescue as well. So he was our coach, and amazing guy to play under. Yeah.
How was his training drills? Was he a hard taskmaster?
He gets stuck into us. He was okay on the training track, but in games, if you were behind at three-quarter time, you'd certainly get a roar. He knew how to order guys around.
Yeah. Part of who he was and what he did.
Mm.
So you said in 2004 it just got too dangerous. So you
It's a confluence of everything.
Yeah.
Sometimes you just got to use intuition. I'd probably been there too long by that stage. Job front. I'd been at a company for 14 years, and they were trying to desize their expat population. They were quite expensive to keep offshore. Had a job going in Sydney to go back to, and Tara and I had a chat, and we decided to chuck it all in and do a bit of travel around Europe. We got married and sort of threw the cards up in the air and see where they landed.
Where did they land?
Where they landed was South America. I was contacted for a role in Chile with a renewables company doing some great work over there, and wasn't a hard sell. It was a pretty tricky interview process. I think it was 6 interviews to get through the process. And all of a sudden, at Christmas, I think it was 2005, we were resettled over in Santiago in Chile.
Had you been to Chile before?
Never.
When you did your research on Chile, what do you remember? What stood out to you?
I didn't do too much research, but quickly realised, just because we learned a bit of Bahasa Indonesia, that wasn't going to cut it. So I was having to get another language under our belt, which Tara did very well, and I took a long time to do. Did a bit of research on footy. I'll get over there and play footy. Like I had so much fun in Asia, and there was just zero going on over there.
So you joined Pacific Hydro, Australian business focused on building renewable energy. What was the role that you walked into?
I was like the regional CFO for Latin America.
Yeah.
So the remit was they were building a bunch of what they call run-of-river hydro schemes. So these are hydro schemes that you don't dam anything.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of low impact. Up in the Andes Mountains, so we had water rights in the two valleys closest to Santiago down south, 2 and 4 hours away. So we were building these hydro cascade schemes to create, renewable energy pathways for Chile.
Yeah, super cool. And we'll come to that in a minute, because you spent just the $1.5 billion on doing a few things there. And I'm really interested in your take on renewables for Australia. But, you know, when I think about Chile, I think about the round ball, Colo Colo, Deportes Tumaco, and Unionist Spanola, Do you think about that, Nick?
Yes. A lot.
Well, they're the teams that I could find on Google. AFL would have been pretty scarce, I would imagine.
Yeah, not too much of a footprint going on there. and we were lucky enough. I do love the round ball as well, so we were lucky enough. I did see a couple of Colo-Colo games.
Did you?
They're the biggest club in Chile.
And
I was lucky enough to go to Argentina to see an El Clásico game too, which is Boca Juniors versus River Plate, which is the craziest sporting event I've ever been to.
In what way?
Just total chaos in the crowd. And yeah, worried for your physical health while you're there. Yeah,
really,
pretty full on. Yeah,
right. Stadium was oversubscribed a little.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, chairs flying down on us from above. I think Boca Juniors, the guy, were at the Stadium Monumental away from Boca, and the Boca guys were above us. I must have got the cheap seats somehow, and they were 2-0 down, and then all this plastic just started being raining on us. We just sat there for 15 minutes with our sort of hands on our heads, protecting our heads.
So you've made it 6 years for Jakarta, but killed by a plastic seat in Chile.
That's right. It was amazing. I came home and was telling Tara about it. She goes, "Oh, are you okay? That sounds terrible." I go, "Mate, that was the best day of my life. It was so good."
If only you had, I was going to say iPhones back then. Would have been a great video.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, you're in this expat community.
Mm.
You decided there was no AFL going on. What did you do about that? What did you create? Talk to our listeners about how you went about doing that.
There was a little bit of luck involved because we just had our first child over there, and our work was so busy. It's probably the busiest the busiest role I've ever had. It was getting these hydros up and getting them funded. But I talked about getting AFL going with a bunch of guys always at barbecues and, you know, every weekend, and yeah, everyone would roll their eyes. And just through good luck, a Chilean guy called Pablo Mahias came over. He was an Adelaide boy, and he'd come back to, I guess, study in Chile and search his family's origins. And he wandered into the Chilean consulate and met a friend of ours, Julie Shields, in the consulate, and they were talking about visas. And he said, "Oh, by the way, is there any footy going on here?" She said, "Nah, but there's a guy across the road at Pacific Hydro. He's setting up a footy team. He talks about it every week, but he doesn't do anything."
Right.
So next thing you know, Pablo, I get a call from reception saying there's a Pablo Mahias, and he wants to talk to you about Football Australiano. And I was like, "Oh, okay." So I brought him in, and he introduced himself and said, "I'm from Adelaide. I'm Pablo. I'm a DJ. I used to play Port Adelaide in the seconds. I've got a coaching certificate. And what do you reckon?" And so I shook his hand and said, "You're coach." So we decided to. So now we have to form a club.
Right.
So we got the. Pretty much 2 weeks later, we had our first training, and 16 guys came down. Good first training at a park up the road, and kicked off from there.
What do you do? Just put out an email, or just put the word around.
Put the word around, and all the guys have been waffling on about at the barbecues. They all came down, and a couple of Pablo's cousins. That was just terrific. So, yeah, we got it going. I was really determined at the time to make sure if we're going to start it up, we do it properly. And so, before we even trained, I think we had a committee meeting. We got a couple of sponsors going, appointed roles, and then after we'd trained for a while, we had a big launch date with 100 people at a restaurant, with the ambassador coming down to present Guernseys to everybody and all of that. So we had all that going. We just needed somewhere to play then. We hadn't played a game, but we had all this great infrastructure.
And where did you actually source the Sharons from?
Most of the guys that had come over from Melbourne would have a footy kit bag. And then I think at the time the AFL sent some over when we got some Auskick going, and they sent some over.
What was the name of the team?
That was an easy choice. They were called the Saints because Santiago itself means Saint Tiago. So we were called the Saints, and in Chilean we were Los Santos. Great little footy club, still going today.
So Los Santos, you've got some sponsors. Who was sponsoring by the way?
First round, or my company put some money in. My boss at the time was a St Kilda supporter, and he reckons I called it the Saints just to get some money.
Smart, yeah.
So and KPMG put some money in, and the other one, Orica, put some money in. They were in our building as well.
They've all got deep pockets. That's good.
Yeah, that was good. And then by the time after we played our first game, BHP put some money into. They became our shorts sponsor.
Oh, really?
BHP on the shorts.
Yep.
Some big names straight up.
Yeah.
So you've got the team. Who do you play?
Yeah, that's always a problem. There's there was no teams going on.
I guess you're a premier straight away.
Yeah, that's it. Reigning champs always. No other team. So I got on the blower. My Spanish was pretty terrible, so it was quite tricky. And got on the blower and tried to track down some teams through the embassy to see what we could do over in Argentina, the closest neighbour. It's only a two-hour flight. Then I came across an NGO that deals in alternative sports, and the guy I spoke to over there, a guy called Ricardo Acuna, fantastic guy. He basically said, I know about AFL, I used to watch it, and we've tried it over here in Argentina through our alternative sports program. If you bring a team over, I'll get a game going. So we... 6 months later, we took a team over. We had the first ever international, Chile versus Argentina, in Buenos Aires. Just a fantastic occasion. Unfortunately for us, he'd recruited a whole bunch of rugby guys that they knew about AFL and had watched it and they'd trained for the game. But they went straight for our hips and crunched us for a full hour and a half, and we were sore as buggery afterwards.
One of the guys broke an ankle, was that? Was that early on, or was that another match?
No, there was a guy from Brisbane, Dave McLaughlin. He played other sports. He never played AFL, and he thought he'd come along and try. He came off the bench, ran towards the ball. A rugby guy went for him. Crack, three ribs gone. Went straight off, retired without recording a career stat.
Never a stat. One game.
Never let him live that down.
No, he gets reminded of
it. Yeah, yeah. And your captain never quite made it, is that right?
Yeah, we had a fantastic captain. He's a mate of mine, a guy called Jackie Coob, and it was a freezing cold time. Obviously, winter over in South America it can be pretty chilly, and we're all on different flights for some reason, and Jack was coming from a work trip, I think, and he got fogged out and ended up spending, while we were playing the game, he was stuck on the tarmac in Uruguay. On the airport. So our foundation skipper missed the first ever international.
But I hear he made up for it in the second game with his opening address.
He did. Look, our second game was up in Brazil. I met a guy through Austrade, a fantastic guy called Greg Wallace from Adelaide, a big footy man. I met him he sat next to him at a business dinner, and he said, if you can get the Saints up to Rio, I'll scour the length and breadth of Brazil for enough Aussies to get a team together. And he did that. He had a team of 20-odd, I think. And the next year, we took the guys up to Rio to play a game of footy, which happened to be my last ever game.
That's amazing. Like, you're jumping on planes, you're flying 2 hours for a game of footy. How much of it's about the footy and how much of it's about the community?
The footy's quite serious. It really hammered home to me. When we played up in Rio, we had six Chileans in our squad, and it was a really hard game in the heat. Really, really, really perspiring game. And basically after we won only by a goal, and the photos after the game, the guys had the Chilean flag out and the cup, and it was like the proudest day of their life. They were so happy that they'd represented Chile and against Brazil and won. For us, it was a bit more about fun and exercise and going up to Rio and all that, but it really meant a lot to these guys. It was terrific.
Yeah.
But at this stage, it's just one-off games as quickly as you can find a team to play against. Is that right?
Yeah, plus some through the year in Santiago, whenever there's an occasion, whenever there's Anzac Day or Australia Day, there'd be Chile versus Australia games, or on their Independence Day weekend or something, there's always an occasion to put in the diary. So you have probably three or four local fixtures, and then I think it was always important to have one international every year to keep the interest up.
Yeah. What sort of places are you playing? Wouldn't be too many ovals there, just ready to go for the off season.
Yeah, pretty tricky in Asia. A bit easier in South America because you had a lot of soccer grounds that were sort of two backed onto each other.
Yep.
So we hired one of them for our home ground. I think they're still using the same one as when I was there.
Where are you sourcing goalposts from? Flagpoles?
Mm. In Asia, bamboo. A lot of bamboo goalposts.
Right. So they
flop around a bit in the wind.
Yeah. But, hit the post.
And then in South America, you use the soccer goalposts normally and then extend them, put the vertical posts up. Yeah.
Was it someone's job to carry the extendable goalposts on the plane, or would you source that at the destination?
No, they're always there. But we had back in Indonesia, we actually had a good little ground manager, Pak Kumis, who that was his job, looking after our ground and setting the ground up every day. That was his gig.
That is cool. Mm. So you're at you're in Chile, in San Diego, for what, nearly 5 years, is that right?
Yeah, 4 years.
So what did that club and league become over that five-year period?
Well, the main thing is it kept going. So all these years later, that's going on. They're still playing games against each other. And then once a year, lo and behold, a team's formed in Colombia, in Bogota, the Bogota Bulldogs. So whilst Argentina and Brazil are a bit quieter at the moment, they're playing yearly internationals against each other to keep the thing going.
Yeah.
And that's what happened in Asia all those years ago. There was just a few clubs keeping the pulse going, and then just takes new people to come in. And, you know, I think eventually there'll be a South American Championships and that thing will all get off. But the main thing is there's a pulse going.
Amazing. We're going to come back to footy in a minute, but you've spent 15 years in the, you know, renewable energy sector. You've helped complete a $3 billion sale of Pak Hydro to China's State Power Investment Corp. So I've got a question for you. It's a big question. Mm. And I'm just really interested in your take on, can you see a pathway for renewable energy in Australia? There's considerable debate, week in, week out these days around what the government is doing in terms of its investment in old energy and new energy. What's your take? Can you see a path?
I think I'm allowed to be political now. Yeah. Look, I think it's happening despite government. Already we're up to, probably just under 30% renewables now, and it's all one-way traffic, so industry's doing the job anyway and getting on with it because it's all going one way, not only in Australia but around the world. We're probably the laggards at the moment. Mm. There is a pathway. Everyone's talking net zero emissions by 2050. Eventually Australia will do that. I think what they need to do is find, probably to solve the question about what they're going to do with the communities in our sort of coal-intensive communities, and that should be a really positive challenge for government, not a negative one. We're already seeing down in the Latrobe Valley, for example, we're going to have our first offshore wind farm outside of Sale. That's mooted, and, what a great sort of transition. It's not going to be everyone, obviously, but the things like that communities can start doing, and it's probably going to take 10, 20, 30 years, but you've got to start somewhere.
Yeah.
So, it's happening already. It will happen. It's a runaway train.
Has to happen.
Yeah, absolutely.
And do you see it as this, in Australia, one connected grid, or do you see individual households setting up their own bespoke or individual renewable source?
It's already happening. There's going to be a mix of everything. The grid that connects the eastern states, that's expanding all the time, and that's going to be important, and there's a lot of work and money going to be required to get those grids out to where all the new renewable investment is. So that's probably the government's challenge at the moment. And there will be these little sort of micro communities.
Yeah.
They're happening already. There's test cases going on all over the place, as well as, you know, rooftop solar. So it's going to be a mix of everything that, that solves the problem.
Yeah. You said you're on a sabbatical.
Mm.
What you do next when you go back into the workforce, it probably won't be school teaching. Will it be renewables or something different?
Not sure. I'm open-minded. Probably in the infrastructure space, so whether it's renewables or something else, but no, open-minded about the future.
Yeah. Cool. Keep open-minded. Here's a fast five for you. Mm-hmm. Centred back on your playing days and on footy. Do you have a pre-game ritual or superstition?
No rituals or superstitions, but because I played up in Asia, I think what I tended to do was do as very, very little as possible before a game, and that included warm-up, and it was deliberate. It wasn't wasn't like a Dane Swan type thing. It was a don't expend any energy before the game. Just keep it all in the box, yeah.
Yeah, I like it. Mm. You do that for cricket, Nick, don't you?
You have to. Yeah. Otherwise you risk tearing something right before the game.
The best player that you played with or against, and why?
Played with or against. Played against some fantastic players up in Asia, ex-AFL guys played up there. A lot of ring-ins, especially for big tournaments.
Yeah. Never seen this guy before, tournament on.
That's right. They'd get a lot of clubs would fly up AFL players.
Like who? Like who would?
Well, there was a much publicised issue with Brian Lake, you know, a few years ago. So players of that quality, I didn't obviously play with him, but those type of guys, Brian, when they finish their careers.
That's right. Yeah, yes. Yeah.
He played for Indonesia. But no, I'll go back to my junior days. I played played with in a couple of combined teams with Steve Silvani as a kid when I was very young, my son's age now.
Yeah. Went all right, Steve, didn't he, old sauce?
He did all right.
Yeah.
One of us went a bit further than the other.
Yep. All right. The hardest...
He was terrible at renewables. Yeah.
The hardest conditions, most oppressive conditions that you've played under?
Hardest conditions, always our yearly derby that we played in Bali. Just so hot and really, really, I won't say filthy games, but there was a lot of tempers flaring. It was like in any derby. It was the Indonesian derby, and we played one game, my first game ever there. This is meant to be a short fight, but I will tell you this story.
Yeah.
My first ever game there, we played on a Kampung paddock out in Bali, and we had a whip around for the Kampung that hosted us after the game, and the guy made a little speech afterwards after watching the game. He said, "Thank you very much for the donation to the community, and you're welcome to come back and fight in my village next year."
Wow.
Yeah.
That much fighting going on.
That was his interpretation of our sport.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
So the pitch to him was, we've got 40 blokes who want to come and fight on your field. There's a ball involved, but...
Yeah. That and goals, but nah, they don't really matter.
Mm. And just on the weather in Bali, is there a better time of year than another to play sport in that part of the world?
There's a wet season, I think early in the year, so you kind of avoid it around, might be Feb, March from memory, but the rest of the time it's just hot.
Right, so the choice is too much water or too hot.
Yeah. It's really, really, really hard to play footy there.
The furthest you've ever travelled for a game?
Played in Tokyo. That was good. Played in a tournament there. Fantastic trip. Couple of expat teams and three Japanese teams to play against. It was amazing in itself. They do a great job up there. They're the guys that have got footy going in Japan. And then, yeah, probably Rio's the other one.
Their most unique ground?
Most unique ground. Ooh. I haven't thought about that, but, yeah, played on a lot of soccer grounds, and I think this whole concept of AFL Sevens that's going on now came from probably expats playing modified rules up in Asia.
And the best club song. We like you brought these teams, clubs, leagues together. Were you responsible for starting up the club songs? Or
we did. The one I remember, again, going back to my juniors,
yeah.
There was a club we used to play against called East Doncaster, and it was their theme song was bless them all, they'd say, and back to their home grounds they fall. There's been a disaster. They've played East Doncaster. Like, I've never forgotten that line.
I like it.
Under 10s, I've never forgotten that line. Like, yeah. A great club song.
Yeah.
Well, we wish you'd brought your guitar for that.
Yeah, I was...
Punch that one out.
Yep.
So you've done some amazing... Yeah, well, for our listeners, I did ask. Rob has, through lockdown, you've been learning to play the guitar, haven't you?
Yep.
And I said, could you bring it along and play us out with a song? But you consulted Tara and she said...
Yeah, I asked Tara and she said, I don't think that's a good idea.
That's some feedback on your on your
honest
guitar
feedback,
playing.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so you've done some amazing things, not only in your career but in and around footy, and you've, from at the top of the episode we talked about, you've joined the AFL Asia Board. What do you see happening over the course of the next 12, 24, 36 months for footy in Asia?
Well, I'm only one board meeting in, I guess, but I think it's all about, there's a couple of key priorities. One's just to get through this whole COVID thing and all the clubs up in Asia having to pivot and have a more sort of a local development bent. So there'll be some positives come out of that. There's, there's 15,000 players up in Asia at the moment. It's a big footprint.
That is massive, isn't it?
20 countries or in 50 schools. There's 230 clubs, I think, or 230 teams. Yep. So there's this footprint. It's about where do we want to take that and how we can grow the game and make it better and using the resources and the know-how and the skills of the AFL to sort of help pump that along a bit.
Yeah. Well, we can't wait to see what you do next in that space. So as we wind up, so some advice from you, Rob. So for those Doolanders out there that are considering creating something brand new, whether it be a business or a community or a sporting team, what's your advice in how you bring all of that together?
I think just get involved. It's I'm not telling people anything new there. Be part of your community. Get involved. If you're offshore, get involved in a local club and include the local communities when you do it and have a real development bent around that. They'd be the main things I'd say.
Some of these things took you, if not weeks, months, but years to build and create. That takes dedication and I'd say, some resilience in all of that. What's your take on that, because it's not, you said created a team in Chile and then 6 months later you're playing a team in BA. I would imagine that it takes resilience and dedication.
Yeah, and I think a little bit of just try and make it happen, move the peanut forward, find a way, yeah. There's people out there that are like-minded. You just got to find them, I guess, and keep going until you do.
Love it. Keep going until you do and move the peanut forward.
Haven't heard that one yet.
Now you have. Rob Spurt, thank you very much for coming on the Doolanders. Cracking story. Really appreciate you sharing that with our Doolanding listeners.
Thanks for having me on. It's been great fun.
Cheers, mate.
Thanks, Rob.
Cheers.
That was Rob Spurr. Now, you're the president of the local footy club.
Yep.
By the way, when you were appointed the president of the local footy club, did they give you some sort of jacket?
No. I got a set of keys.
But no jacket, not like some sort of blazer.
Maybe that could be my legacy. I'll start the jacket.
What sort of jacket would you?
We are a red and white club, the Devils.
So red leather jacket or?
No, probably something more traditional, like a blazer.
A red blazer.
Yeah.
Wow. so you know how much work goes into running just one club.
Yep.
Like, Rob, to create that community, jumping on planes. To, like,
oh, amazing. Yeah. This is different. So in a club environment where you're a custodian of a club, it was started 15 years ago by some locals, and that club then joined a league which was already existing.
Yeah.
So that in itself is very different. Rob created a club and a league across different countries.
Countries, yeah.
Across a continent.
Yeah.
And that is what I love about this story is that, yeah, he had an interest in it and he was talking about it at barbecues and it took a little spark when someone came to him and said, actually, I'm interested in doing this. I was surprised how quickly he could get 18 blokes together.
Yeah.
To actually do it, and then to start calling up another country and going, actually, do you guys have 18 people? Hey, because we've got a team, we'll play your team, and then it all started, and it's still going today.
Yeah.
That's huge. And it would not have started if not for Rob. It's not one of those things where you think, oh, eventually it would have started. The AFL is not pouring millions of bucks into South America.
Yeah. Look, that's passion to do something that he loves. Plus, create that community. Like it really, an amazing thing. And I'm really excited to see what happens next with AFL Asia.
Yeah,
like his role on that board, it will be super fascinating. You can, like, you think about Australian rules footy, and I think he said it to us either on air or off air that, you know, next year, the year after, in a couple of years' time, there'll be some 7-foot-8 person coming out of some Asian country playing AFL, and we'll be going over there to more and more people who are going over there to recruit these massive guys in.
Yeah, and the engagement of the Chinese game, so the Port Adelaide versus Gold Coast, is actually really high. From the Australian perspective, you go, what are we wasting our time doing that for?
Yeah.
But the engagement levels are actually really high. And, yeah, that's it's amazing that he'll be part of that process. Not a surprise that he'll be part of that process on the advisory board or being asked to be on it. But, geez, it'll be fascinating to see where it goes.
Yeah, sure will. I would have loved to have been in the, in what do they call it? The City Square. No, what was it? What was it called? Burke Street Mall. When he was in there on the on the brass man swinging the fish.
We should get it. We should see if Rob can find that man with the fish and get him to swing the fish in front of our studio here to drum up more listens to the podcast.
I like it. That's a great idea. All right, mate. Well, that was Rob Spurr. He was amazing. Who have we got coming up next week?
Do you mean episode 28?
That is exactly what I mean.
Episode 28 is, of course, the amazing Declan Fay.
Declan Fay. Funny, funny man.
He is. We'll see you then.
Thanks, Doolanders. Hey, Doolanders. If you want to hear more inspiring stories and have this show grow to more and more listeners, do us a favour. Can you like, share, rate and review the Doolander podcast on wherever you get your podcast from?
Wherever good pods are cast.
That's where...